Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of last night's Democratic presidential debate from Flint, Michigan, in which both candidates agreed that Michigan Governor Snyder should resign or be recalled. But mostly they leveled attacks at each other, with Bernie Sanders portraying Hillary Clinton as the candidate beholden to Wall Street, while she accused him of opposing the auto bailout. Lawrence Jacobs, the director of the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert H. Humphrey School of Political Affairs and the Walter F. and Joan Mondale Chair of Political Studies at the University of Minnesota, joins us to discuss who won the debate and what impact it will have on tomorrow's Michigan primary. Then we'll look into the emergency summit today in Brussels between the EU and Turkey's prime minister, who offered to take back all the refugees from Syria who flooded into Europe in exchange for more aid money and a faster track towards EU membership for Turkey. A specialist on Turkey and the Kurdish regions, Max Hoffman, a political analyst in national security and international policy at the Center for American Progress, joins us to discuss how the migration crisis is being used as a bargaining chip while Turkey's government brazenly flouts EU standards by taking over the country's largest opposition newspaper. Then finally, we will speak with Paulo Sotero, the director of the Brazil Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center, about the recent federal police raid on Lula da Silva's house, sweeping up the popular former president of Brazil, who has claimed there is, quote, not a more honest living soul in the country than him. In Operation Car Wash, an investigation into kickbacks and money laundering at the state oil company Petrobras, a widening corruption scandal that has paralyzed Lula's successor, Brazil's current president, Dilma Rousseff. And joining us now is Lawrence Jacobs, who is the Walter F. and Joan Mondale Chair of Political Science at the University of Minnesota, where he also directs the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert H. Humphrey School of Political Affairs. His books include Talking Together, Public Deliberation in America and the Search for Community, and Class War, Economic Inequality and the American Dream. And he has a forthcoming book, Fed Power, How Finance Wins. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Jacobs.
Good to be back with you.
And what did you make of the debate last night between the two remaining Democratic candidates? And it did seem at times, even though they both agreed on having Michigan's Governor Snyder either resign or be recalled, they seemed to spend most of the evening sniping at each other. Hillary Clinton was accused of being beholden to Wall Street, while she accused Bernie Sanders of opposing the auto bailout. How do you navigate that line between these primaries making the candidates sharper and better, at the same time taking each other down and spending money, which is going to hurt them in the general?
Well, I think it is a tricky line. I would just quickly add that if you listen to the Democratic debate, you would hear something that was sort of lacking in the Republican debates, which is a genuine engagement in policy debates over trade, over health reform, over government policy towards the auto industry. There was a lot of substantive issues that was hashed out, and there are genuine differences between the two candidates.
Well, but is there a deficit there between the intelligence and reasoning and policy and real politics and the other side, what's often referred to as emotional intelligence, if you will, that where you've got the Republicans having this outrageous brawl and reality TV taking over from political discourse, but at the same time, they're getting record numbers of people out. So, and there's an enthusiasm deficit that's often talked about. So I guess my broader question is, are the American people interested in facts, or are they interested in kind of a blood sport, a political theater?
Well, I think this is a very special phase of the presidential election. This is the phase where each party figures out its nominees, and clearly the Republicans are on fire with regard to their intense dislike of Barack Obama, their deep anxiety and fears about where the country is heading as it becomes more multiracial, and as economic insecurity remains, versus the Democratic side, where you've got one candidate, Hillary Clinton, who's running as Barack Obama's continuation into a third term, And Bernie Sanders, who's launched a pretty energetic but quite substantive campaign, taking issue with the limitations of the Obama term. So these are very different, but they're each aimed at their distinct base of the party that will be determining who's going to be the nominee. And I think for Hillary Clinton, she is very close to wrapping up this battle. It will drag on, it seems, for several more months, but I think within a week's time, Hillary Clinton will have you know, really put an insurmountable lead between her and Bernie Sanders. Republican side, I think there's a lot more uncertainty how that's going to work out.
So if Hillary Clinton does well tomorrow in Michigan, there's still a long way to New York in April and California in June, where Bernie Sanders is expected to gobble up a lot of delegates. So will she have an insurmountable lead before New York and California?
Yes, for sure. I think it's quite possible she's going to have a very large win tomorrow in Michigan, and she's going to follow it up with large wins in Florida and Ohio. And at that point, it's going to be just a, you know, insurmountable advantage where she'll have the nomination not cinched up, but it'll be just a matter of time until she does.
So what was your sense then of some of the moments that the press have seized on where Bernie Sanders sort of more or less told Hillary Clinton to shut up? And I mean, there were times when he was prickly, he got a little lost at one point, and there were also times when he was just hammering her, and she was just sort of sitting there taking it, which made me think, well, you know, she obviously doesn't want to really pick a fight because she wants to have Bernie's people vote for her in the fall.
Well, I think there were periods where Hillary Clinton was letting Senator Sanders dig a hole for himself. So if you go to the part of the debate about the bailout of the auto industry, which is in Michigan, which is going to have this very important primary on Tuesday, Bernie Sanders made a very impassioned argument that this was another Wall Street bailout. And Hillary Clinton sat there, smiled, let him make his argument, but then quickly turned on him and said, if everyone in the Senate had voted as Senator Sanders is proposing, and as he voted, then the auto industry with 4 million jobs would have gone down. And that is a very potent argument to be making in Michigan to an audience who relies on those jobs.
Well, I think he was at a disadvantage, and he has been, because he comes out of the Senate explaining the arcane nature of how Senate bills are put together with all these various amendments and all the poison pills and stuff. I mean, that seems to have never – I mean, the public wants simple answers, don't they?
They do want simple answers, but I think he – you know, Senator Sanders has been very articulate about the role of money and the sense that – a few big interests have taken over Washington, but Hillary Clinton's been, I think, equally effective, if not more effective, in countering, in being able to point to concrete policies that were passed that did help working people. And I think the saving of the auto industry is obviously a very potent case to be made in the town where the auto industry resides. And she's done this on health reform and the Dodd-Frank Wall Street reforms. You know, it doesn't satisfy the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, but it's enough that it's really kind of reassured mainline Democrats and connected again and again with the Democratic base among African Americans and sometimes Hispanics.
But how do you explain then why Bernie Sanders is ahead in a lot of polls in a matchup against Donald Trump? He does better than Hillary Clinton.
Well, I do think Hillary Clinton's got a challenge when it comes to the general election. And part of the challenge is that, you know, being in public life for several decades at her level, she's built up a lot of scar tissue. And so her unfavorable ratings are quite close to Donald Trump's. you've got about 6 out of 10 voters saying that they don't trust her or consider her honest. And, you know, Democrats disagree about Bernie Sanders' his policy, but there's overwhelming support in the exit polls that he's honest and trustworthy. So, yeah, there's no doubt that she's got challenges ahead. But you kind of project into the general election, and Hillary Clinton's positioning herself for a general election battle, whereas Bernie Sanders has taken positions, for instance, his single-payer plan, his plan for providing free college education and expanding Social Security. Estimates are that that would increase the size of government by 40 to 50%. And, you know, that's going to be a liability in a general election, and Republicans would savage him for that. Hillary Clinton's certainly going to take a lot of abuse, but she's been more cautious in finding positions that she'll be able to sustain when you get to the general election and the audience is more moderate and you've got to win over those swing voters among the independents.
But what about the enthusiasm deficit that I talked about with Trump getting record crowds? And on the other side, Bernie Sanders is the one that gets the crowds. And if you followed the applause last night, mm-hmm. Bernie Sanders would have won the debate if that were the measure.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think there's no doubt that that Hillary Clinton is a candidate with a lot of challenges, and I think this enthusiasm gap is part of it. I don't think it's going to hurt her winning the nomination on the Democratic side, but if she can't excite and turn out the base of the Democratic Party for the general election, she's going to have a very hard time winning the key states of Florida and Ohio, where Democrats need very large turnout from African Americans and from Hispanics and others. So yes, there's no doubt you're raising a very legitimate point.
Well, I guess just in closing, it would seem that her challenge will be to keep the Bernie Sanders people in her tent.
Yes, I think that is absolutely going to be critical. I think at this point, it's still a pretty vigorous campaign.
Sure.
And I think, to Senator Sanders' credit, he's pointing to policy differences. But this is a very different tone from what we've seen on the Republican side, which has been name-calling and some vulgarity.
Sure.
This is a much more principled, kind of high-minded sort of policy debate. So I could imagine a situation when we roll around to the July convention when, Bernie Sanders has a prime time spot at the convention and savages the Republican candidate and throws his support to Hillary Clinton. That all seems quite possible.
Well, Lawrence Jacobs, I thank you very much for joining us.
Good to be with you again.
And again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Jacobs, who's the Walter F. and Joan Mondale Chair of Political Studies at the University of Minnesota, where he also directs the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert H. Humphrey School of Political Affairs. His books include Class War, Economic Inequality, and the American Dream. His latest book out soon is Fed Power, How Finance Wins. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the emergency summit today in Brussels between the EU and Turkey's Prime Minister.
There's
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Max Hoffman, who's a policy analyst on the National Security and International Policy team at the Center for American Progress, focusing on Turkey and the Kurdish regions, U.S. defense budgeting and policy, and the intersection of climate change, human migration, and security concerns. He has organized and undertaken repeated research trips to Turkey, Iraq, and Lebanon. Welcome to Background Briefing, Max Hoffman.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And there's a meeting underway in Brussels between the EU leaders and Turkey's prime minister. And it looks as though Turkey's trying to sort of leverage its way into an agreement to enter the EU, which has been stalled for, I think, over a decade, by offering to take back all of the refugees that have flowed from Turkey to Greece and into Europe, and that's over a million refugees. They're saying that Turkey will take them back in return for more money, faster visa-free travel for Turks, and accelerated EU membership talks. So this has caught the European negotiators by surprise somewhat, I understand.
That seems to be the case. You summed it up quite well. Turkey knows it has the EU in the corner. It's been seeking membership for many, many years. I don't think it's realistic that this latest migrant crisis and refugee crisis will fundamentally alter the calculus there. I don't think Turkey will gain full membership, but they are pressing for some concessions short of that. You mentioned the visa-free travel. That's been something they've been seeking for quite some time. The EU had, already offered a little over $3 billion in aid for Turkey, to help care for the Syrian refugees if Turkey agreed to slow the flow of migrants to Europe. But now, apparently, Davutoğlu has sort of played a bit of a trump card at the summit in Brussels and is demanding, some reports say double that, some reports say even more than $6 billion. They're asking for more chapters to be open for their EU accession talks to at least help move that process forward. And the Europeans, I think, are scrambling to respond currently, but the details are still emerging. But what's clear is that Turkey is leveraging the refugee crisis with over 1 million already in Europe, more than 2,000 a day by most reports coming in, crossing into Greece from Turkey. It's a very potent political issue. You've seen that with the rise of far-right extremist parties in Eastern Europe and elsewhere, in sort of main big European countries. Just this weekend, Slovakia elected what is essentially a neo-Nazi party on a very xenophobic, sort of anti-immigrant platform to win a few seats in their parliament. Germany faces regional elections this Sunday, and I think most European analysts would say that it's a real threat to Angela Merkel's coalition and to her party. So this is, for political leaders in Europe, an existential issue, the refugee crisis. And Erdogan knows that, and Davutoğlu knows that, and they're playing it to their advantage, somewhat cynically.
And if, for example, there was a possibility of returning the emigrants to Turkey, assuming that Europe would agree to the more than doubling of the original payments to subsidize the refugees that Turkey has taken in, and it has cost Turkey. They're not without a case here, obviously. But I've heard reports that Turkey's pretty cynical about the refugee situation from Syria and might well be willing to live with a lot of displaced Syrians in that border area to squeeze out the Kurds.
Well, that's an interesting angle, bringing the Kurds into it. Turkey's faced facing two big crises right now. One is, of course, the over 2 million, some say close to 3 million Syrian refugees fleeing the conflict there. And as you say, they've done a tremendous job caring for those people. They've tried to provide education there. The refugee camps in which some of those refugees live are apparently fairly well maintained, but most of the refugees have been absorbed into Turkish society. And if you travel in Turkey, it's remarkable. There are Syrian beggars on the streets, but Turkish society has gone to great lengths to care for them, and that's a tribute to their country and to the government, frankly. But you contrast that and the very moral point they are making, that we have borne the burden of this crisis thus far. We have protected you, the Europeans, from the brunt of it, and we want some financial support. We want help now. You contrast that with the somewhat cynical tactics they're using to secure that support, tactics that may have been forced upon them by the Europeans' reluctance to provide real assistance earlier in the crisis. But it's an interesting contrast. Turkey is pressing, as you sort of alluded to, they're pressing for safe zones along the border with Syria. They have been for some time now. The big question, and their hope is that these safe zones would be protected from Assad regime bombing, from the Russians bombing, and would provide a safe place for some refugees to return. Those plans seem pretty unrealistic. Those safe zone plans seem pretty unrealistic today. The big thing that changed is, of course, Russia's involvement, and then the subsequent Turkish downing of a Russian jet. That means that any Turkish sort of intervention across the border, any effort to set up one of these safe zones, is likely to be met with force by the Russians and the Syrian regime. And those safe zones would not be very safe. And it's very hard to see any refugees returning to those areas. So Turkey continues to push for this, but they are, you know, meeting with real reluctance on the part of the U.S. and European allies to assist them in doing that. The Kurdish issue you mentioned is another humanitarian catastrophe that Turkey is facing, one largely of their own creation in this case. In Turkey's southeast right now, there's what amounts to a low-grade civil war between Kurdish separatists or at least those fighting for greater Kurdish autonomy and the government. The fighting is, you know, in the streets in poor areas of Kurdish majority Kurdish cities in the southeast, and it's caused its own much smaller but serious refugee crisis with, you know, between 250 and 300,000 Kurdish residents of Turkey's southeast displaced. So that's another crisis they're dealing with. But that's one that they are largely responsible for. It all adds up to a very bleak picture, of course, in which Turkey's under this tremendous strain. There is civil unrest and outright fighting in the southeast. And there are, of course, huge tensions with the European allies and with the United States over Syria policy.
Well, obviously, one of the factors that is bothering the Europeans is the nature of Erdogan's somewhat megalomaniacal and as well kleptocratic rule, but the blatant closing of the Turkish top-selling newspaper, Zaman, and literally just, you know, using the courts like Putin does, using the courts to basically close them down, and then the next day they're printing pro-government stuff. Now, they've apparently, Zaman plans to continue publishing as an opposition daily in Germany. I'm not sure how that's going to work out, but I'm sure the Europeans have brought up this issue. And so much of Turkey's recent problems have been brought upon itself by Erdogan's erratic leadership and his plans to basically permanently install himself as the supreme leader. And that seems to be, that's what's motivated him, and a lot of it's backfired, hasn't it?
Yes, well, the seizure of Zaman on Friday is a very, very troubling development. Zaman, it's the equivalent of police under prosecutorial order shutting down the Wall Street Journal or something. It's a very big deal. Zaman was the largest, by distribution, the largest opposition paper. And it's essentially been shut down. This is a new tactic the government is using to shut down opposition outlets. They put them under administration, saying that they're not being properly administered for their shareholders, and then subsequently changing the editorial line and firing any staff who don't go along. It's the continuation of a long-running trend, a long-running crackdown on press freedom overseen by Erdogan and the AKP government. And as you say, it's wrapped up in his, what has become, in any event, his quest for personal domination of Turkey's politics. It now means that Zaman is under administration and will likely be shut down, or at least not survive in its true opposition form. And then the editors-in-chief of the other two independent papers in Turkey, Hürriyet and Cumhuriyet, both editors-in-chief are under indictment currently, one for insulting the president and one on espionage charges for reporting on Turkish intelligence agency's efforts to smuggle weapons into Syria for Islamist rebel groups. So really, there is no press freedom or very little press freedom in Turkey today, and that's a very sad state of affairs. It's the culmination of a long-running trend. They've slowly forced the owners of opposition outlets to sell or at least to tone down the editorial line. They've levied big tax fines against opposition papers. There's a Hürriyet, the sort of last remaining semi-independent paper in Turkey, is owned by a company called Doğan Group. They levied a $2 billion lira tax fine against Doğan Group. They canceled a Doğan, you know, the conglomerate had a contract to build two frigates for the Turkish Navy, and they canceled that contract after criticism from the newspaper. So they are very vindictive and using all the tools of government power to stamp out dissent. And there's additional context here. Turkey has blocked Twitter shortly before elections. They are now the leading, the country that makes the most requests to Twitter to block users and take down content, more even than Russia, far, far, far more than the United States or any other country. It's really Turkey, Russia, and then nobody else. So this is a very troubling trend. They are stamping out all forms of dissent and stamping out press freedom. And there is a big question about what the U.S. or the European Union can do to counter that trend.
But surely one of the conditions for Turkey's accession into the EU, which has been stalled for a long time, I understand one of the reasons. I mean, there's some elements, I think, of European racism. The French have been fairly obdurate about it. But on the European side, they're basically saying, well, if you want to join the EU, you've got to join and accept our, you know, societal standards of press freedom and human rights, etc. And clearly, this closing of the main opposition newspaper and literally taking it over one day and the next day having pro-government propaganda on the front pages is something that's not going to help. So how do you think the bargaining's going on the European side? Can't they surely have a case with what Erdogan's done, but is he that brazen?
That's almost the most disturbing thing about this latest seizure is how blatant and in the open it was. Previously, Erdogan had relied on sort of more subtle techniques, again, pressuring the owners or calling up the editor and applying political pressure in that way. But to just storm in and seize the paper is pretty remarkable. You're right. This is absolutely in flies in the face of European values and of the, you know, stipulated requirements for EU membership. The reason Erdogan one of the reasons Erdogan's willing to risk it is that I don't think he believes there is any likelihood of EU accession anytime soon. And that is both Turkey's fault and the Europeans' fault. For many years, the EU accession process was a vehicle for reform in Turkey. Even in Erdogan's early years, the early years of AKP rule from 2002 to 2007 or 2008, depending sort of where you draw the line, they used the EU process as a way to modernize and reform Turkey. They made big strides initially on press freedom, on the inclusion of religious religious people into society, the inclusion of Kurds into society, the opening up of the economy, a lot of really positive steps tied to the EU process. But that has just fallen apart. It's a long story how that happened, but largely it was the process of Erdogan beginning to essentially tie his own personal ambition to the rise of the country and see them as one and the same thing. And it is, as you said, he is a megalomaniac and he has this burning ambition to dominate Turkish politics. So that is, I think, the core story of how this has happened. But the Europeans contributed to this. They, as you said, somewhat racist, maybe Islamophobic elements on the right in Europe were never serious about the EU accession process, and they strung Turkey along. And eventually Turkish leaders grew wise to that. And it's a very sort of vindictive cycle we're in now. But the core question is how the U.S. and the EU can balance the real concerns they have on the refugee crisis, on Syria, on counterterrorism, on all these really important issues, with real concern about Turkish democracy and the fact that Erdogan is really dragging the country in this authoritarian direction. And it's very hard because Erdogan is a populist, and so any public criticism from the U.S. or the EU plays into his hands. It plays into his narrative of victimhood and Western meddling or even imperialism or Islamophobia that he sells to his primarily working class, Sunni, more devout constituency in Turkey. And so I think Obama and many, Merkel have calculated that public criticism will just play into his hands. But at some point you have to make a stand as things continue to deteriorate. So we're in this cycle where the migration crisis has caused and Turkey's democratic recession have caused legitimate criticism along with somewhat illegitimate Islamophobia in Europe and even, let's not kid ourselves, in the U.S. And that that gives Erdogan more to point to and say, look, we're right. They never trusted us. They were never going to let us into this union, and I'm the only one you can trust. So it's this vicious cycle, and no one has any brilliant ideas currently of how to break out of it.
But as I mentioned earlier, though, Max Hoffman, some of what Erdogan's done seems to have backfired, starting a war with the Kurds in order to get himself, omnipotent electoral power. Seems to have backfired, even though he finally won his second round. But ambushing that Russian plane and shooting it down has clearly backfired. Putin apparently has total contempt for Erdogan and is putting the squeeze on. And Russia has a lot of economic leverage over Turkey, and the Russian press is full of racist insults to the Turks.
I think the Russian shoot down was a very serious mistake on Turkey's part. The Russian planes had violated Turkish airspace repeatedly. They'd been warned repeatedly. The Russians were bombing Turkish-backed rebels just across the border, and I think Turkey just lost patience. But it took a lot of options off the table for Turkey when it comes to Syria. For example, the safe zones now, their number one priority when it came to Syria policy for years is essentially off the table now because the West can't risk any sort of incursion, that, of, at least including Turkish forces, that might provoke the Russians to take revenge for that shoot down. So that took that option off the table. As you said, his crackdown on the Kurds, which was an effort to win over the nationalist vote going into the November 1st elections, has now placed Turkey on a taken Turkey into complete chaos and civil war in the southeast, and now, very unfortunately, to include terrorist bombings in Ankara, and we fear possibly other western Turkish cities, which is a very serious escalation. And as you said, all of this hurts the Turkish economy further. The Turkish economy has been growing very slowly. They're not keeping up with their population growth, and young people are very struggling to find a job. They are very dependent on Russian energy. And the Russians know that and are starting to mess around with energy prices also, which hurts Turkish companies. So it seems as if Erdogan in his drive to accumulate absolute power is painting himself further and further into a corner. You see some signs of discontent even among Erdogan's party, the AKP. Some of the co-founders of the party, who were initially sort of the first among equals with Erdogan at the top, this group of party fathers and elders, have voiced some discontent. And there is a little bit of discontent among the party rank and file. But overall, Erdogan has consolidated control of the party lists and made it very costly for anyone to speak out against him, even among his own party. So he has dominance of Turkish politics for the foreseeable future, and he has an electoral mandate for that dominance, even if those elections were conducted in the context of fear and press, the lack of press freedom and real asymmetry of resources for the governing party, Erdogan's party, against the opposition. But he has an electoral mandate, and he continues to use it to full effect and to put his people in charge of the judiciary and the police and the intelligence agencies and slowly consolidate further power.
Well, he's sort of almost a mirror image of Putin. And just in closing, it's a kind of ironic that Putin is cleaning his clock, if you will. But I just want to get your final comment here, Max, on General Breedlove, the head of NATO. He recently testified before the Senate saying that Vladimir Putin was weaponizing the migration from Syria and that this was a strategy to put pressure on the Europeans and to split European society, which is already getting polarized. You mentioned the fascist party coming in second in Slovenia. Putin has funded some of the right-wing parties like Jobbik in Hungary and Le Pen's party in France. So he's made his intentions clear that he wants to make life miserable for the Europeans. And the flow of refugees has certainly put strains on European society. And clearly, at least General Breedlove's argument is that Putin is trying to break the will of resolve of the Europeans in order to have sanctions lifted from his annexation of Crimea and his invasion of East Ukraine. So what's your comment on General Breedlove's recent statements?
It's a remarkable statement coming from the NATO senior U.S. commander in Europe, it's perhaps a sign of kind of 21st century asymmetrical warfare and politics by other means. I think it's, I don't know if there's any public evidence that we could cite that this is an explicit strategy on Putin's part, but I think two things are certainly going on. The first, in Syria, is that Russian planes are systematically bombing civilians, they're bombing hospitals. They are, I think, intentionally contributing to the refugee flow. Whether that is part of the regime strategy to depopulate rebel areas in order to make it easier for regime troops to hold on to those areas, or whether it's a tactic to increase the pressure on Turkey after Turkey sort of stood up to Putin and shot down his airplane, or some combination of the two, it's certainly going on and it's contributing to the flow of refugees into Turkey and then, of course, on to Europe. And then the other thing, I think you're right. Putin has, even before the refugee crisis, he had backed far-right parties, very, very conservative parties, parties sympathetic to his brand of government and his brand of, homophobia and racism and xenophobia. So that was going on even before this. And he has subsequently found the weak points in the European system and really played upon them, whether it's with Ukraine and prodding Europe's reluctance to confront a bully in Eastern Europe, whether it's Syria and, you know, basically putting the European Union and the U.S.'s inability to stop this crisis right front and center and putting it in their face. He's playing upon the very tender sort of points that hold together the European project and putting the Schengen zone and EU harmonization and all of these important initiatives under tremendous pressure. And the Europeans have not covered themselves in glory in responding to it. And it really will have to come from them. The U.S. can only do so much in support of that. But it's unquestionably causing tremendous human suffering in Syria and increasingly in Turkey and Europe. And I think if his end goal is to have the sanctions removed, he's going about it in a very strange way because there's no mistaking who's at fault for these trends. And it's Putin, it's the Assad regime, and of course, it's ISIS as well.
Well, Max Hoffman, I thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Great talking to you, Ian.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Max Hoffman, who's a policy analyst on the National Security and International Policy team at the Center for American Progress, focusing on Turkey and the Kurdish regions. He has organized and undertaken repeated research trips to Turkey, Iraq, and Lebanon. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about Operation Car Wash, an investigation into kickbacks and money laundering at Brazil's state oil company that has swept up its popular former president.
I am a poor wayfaring stranger, traveling through this world alone. There's no sickness, toil or danger in that bright land to which I go. I'm going there to see my mother.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Paula Sotero, who is the director of the Brazil Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Previously, he was the Washington correspondent for Estado de Sao Paulo, a leading Brazilian daily newspaper, and has been a regular commentator and analyst for the BBC Radio Portuguese Language Service and Radio France Internationale. He also teaches at the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paulo Sotero.
Good afternoon, Ian. Yeah, it's a pleasure to be with you and your listeners.
Well, thank you, Paulo. And I must say, the recent footage of the arrest or detention, I guess, brief as it was, of the former president of Brazil, Lula, who was extremely popular and was extremely indignant about his treatment, and he felt that what happened to him was an insult to democracy itself. But the reason that he was detained was for questioning over corruption with the big state-run oil company, Petrobras, and that seems to be also an inquiry that's affecting President Dilma Rousseff, the current president, and Lula's successor. So give us your analysis of what this is. This feels a bit like Brazil's Watergate.
Yes, you could make that comparison. The subject matter here, which makes many Brazilians indignant, is an assault on the largest company in Brazil that happens to be a state company, Petrobras, giant oil company, that took place over a decade while President Lula da Silva and President Dilma Rousseff were in office. Actually, President Dilma Rousseff was initially Secretary of Energy, then the Chief of Staff for President Lula, and in that capacity she became also the chairperson of the board at Petrobras. This is an assault that cost the company and obviously Brazilians some $3 billion and has basically destroyed the company. It involved some 12 construction companies that used to sell goods and services to Petrobras. It was a scheme to divert funds to political campaigns, to politicians, and to senior managers of Petrobras and other shady characters. This has been under investigation since March of 2014. It has already gone through 24 phases. It has produced some 200 people have been accused. There have been around 80 convictions. 42 plea bargain agreements have been signed by those accused that decided to cooperate with justice. And so, if in the one hand, it's a bit shocking to have a former president as popular as President Lula was once, being summoned to you know, respond to questions about criminal activity. He is not accused directly, but he is obviously called to give explanations because about his knowledge about this. And he reacted the way you correctly described. He was indignant about this and called people to rally in the streets because this is a, he says that this is a disrespect to democracy. Well, there is a debate in Brazil. I believe that most Brazilians would not support the president in that statement. Some and many still admire him from what he did. But in the case of Petrobras, it's clear that there are allegations. Those allegations are not created from thin air. They come from depositions made by former senior executives, CEOs of some major construction companies, senior associates of the Workers' Party and the two other parties that belong to the government coalition, and now to allies of President Dilma and President Lula, like Senator Delcídio Amaral, who was until the month of November 2015 the leader of Rousseff's government in Congress, and has now signed a plea bargain agreement with the prosecutors involving the president directly in some of the wrongdoing. So this is proceeding. The investigation is very much supported, according to polls, has full support of the people in Brazil. Now, it is complicated because it creates enormous tensions. The president is very unpopular. The economy is in a free fall, rising unemployment, rising inflation, a lot of anger around, and the president, according to the latest estimates, opinions in Brazil by people from different areas, the president is not particularly gifted as a politician, is quite isolated, sort of in a very difficult position, has lost credibility. Brazil obviously has lost the confidence of investors. Here we go. Now, this is going to be resolved, and now both the opposition has called for mass protests for this coming Sunday in support of impeaching President Dilma Rousseff. Lula also has called the militants of the Workers' Party and other sympathizers to go to the streets. So you have a risk here of confrontations, etc. But that is the situation. It's tense. I think it's getting it will become more so in the coming days, because we are really in uncharted territory here.
And again, I'm speaking with Paulo Sotero, who is the director of the Brazil Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Previously, he was the Washington correspondent for Estado de São Paulo, a leading Brazilian daily newspaper. So it's obviously a bit of a blow to the Workers' Party and the image of Lula, which was quite international. He was considered to be a sort of model of the new left, if you will, in international affairs. And this Operation Car Wash, which is the investigation that's been going on for some time, that's now got him on the defensive and has pretty much isolated his successor, the current president of Brazil, Dilma Rousseff. And you mentioned on the weekend there's going to be massive demonstrations organized by the conservative opposition, with Lula calling in the left Workers' Party to confront that group of supporters of the opposition. So that could be dangerous. But just to touch on the investigation itself, if you say that the Brazilian people are all in favor of this investigation and they find it credible, then it must be an independent investigation, is it?
Yes, it is an independent investigation being done by a young generation of federal judges, federal prosecutors, federal policemen, a generation that grew up in freedom and democracy, and that represents some of the values that the Workers' Party brought to Brazil. The Workers' Party was once the party of ethics in Brazil, but some of the founding members of that party, some leading figures of that movement, like Marina Silva, the former senator, former minister of the environment, is now calling for the president's impeachment, telling her supporters and followers, and she was twice presidential candidate and is probably likely to be, and Marina Silva is no conservative, to go to the streets and protest. There was an assault against a public company in Brazil that was orchestrated by members of the Workers' Party, its two main allies in government, and an important segment of the business elite in Brazil. And this now, after 30 years in democracy, Brazil has managed to, get institutions in the judiciary party, in the judiciary branch, that has the capacity to act against those things. They are acting under the due process of law. There has been 416 appeals to superior courts on acts by Lava Jato. Of those, the superior courts, whose members are all nominated by the or almost all nominated, is their majority for members for governments of the Workers' Party, have granted only 16. It's less than 4%. So this is not a bunch of cowboys, conservative right-wing cowboys, going after people for no reason. The statements being put out, the allegations involving, unfortunately, people that serve the government in Brazil, they are being made by allies of President Lula, by allies, former allies of President Lula, former allies of President Dilma, and people that until recently were there with them, serving the government. So why they are doing that? Because the allegations are very serious, because Brazil is starting those a protest. You may remember in 2013, there were massive protests in Brazil, and one of the reactions to that protest by politicians was, for instance, to adopt the American-style plea bargain agreements. President Dilma Rousseff was the one that signed that into law. Plea bargain has become law in Brazil in January of 2014. That device is the one being used by this young generation of prosecutors, young generation of judges, many of them with master's degree in American universities. To pursue this investigation, it's very difficult to say that this is a political vendetta of sorts. These are not people that are particularly associated with any parties. They are professionals. They are public servants. They are very well trained. They are decently paid, and they are independent.
Well, it would seem to me, though, that a part of this story that's inextricable, that is the economy itself that's really tanking seriously, with a depression-era contraction rate of 3.8% this year. And, of course, we're talking about all of that money that was sloshing around in Petrobras, the state-owned oil company that's the source of this Operation Car Wash investigation. The reason there's so much money flowing around and being embezzled, apparently, was because of the high price of oil. So oil has gone down. Commodities, which Brazil exports, have gone down, particularly to China, because China's contracting. So in general, it seems like a perfect storm. And on top of that, of course, you've got the Zika virus. Is that your sense, that just Brazil is being incredibly hard hit economically and the economy is in free fall and the government doesn't seem to know what to do? That has to be a big part of this.
Yes, it is indeed precisely like you described. But here is one important point to understand. This crisis is not the result of an international crisis, the impact of an international crisis. Okay, Brazil was growing very well until the year 2010, the last year of President Lula in term. But Brazil failed, the Brazilian government failed to read the change of international reality, the fact that the commodities boom was ending and that we should have reverted our economy to one that would seek more investment, more productive investment instead of promoting consumption. And we didn't do that, and we, instead of changing, we deepen our tradition of state intervention in the economy in order to stimulate the economy, in order to choose the big national champions, etc. And this is what created the economic crisis in Brazil. They overextended the state in Brazil for 4 years. The 4 years before this crisis hit, the economy grew at very anemic rates. The 4 years, first 4 years of President Dilma Rousseff, were the slowest in Brazil, were the second set of slowest 4 years of growth in Brazil in about a century. And then we hit this, we get to this moment, which is self-inflicted. The commodities boom ended for everybody. It didn't end up for Brazil, and other countries adapted earlier. They converted, they opened their economies, for instance. Brazil has one of the closest economies in Latin America, incapable more and more of attracting more and more, investors. The investors that are there, there are thousands of foreign investors in Brazil, important firms, including many from California. They are staying there hoping that the situation will turn around. But we know, and this is discussed all the time in Brazil, we have to change our economy and make it more attractive to Brazilian and to foreign investors. It's very bureaucratic. The government is very interventionist. And, on top of this, the president and her government have lost credibility. I am actually happen to be a good friend with the gentleman that the president, after her re-election in October 2014, invited to be the finance minister. His name is Joaquin Levy. He's now working at a senior position at the World Bank here in Washington, and he tried to restore fiscal equilibrium, etc. He gave up because it was not possible. The party of the president didn't want to do that. It's painful. You have to contract. You have to raise taxes. You have to cut expenditures because that, and you have to do this in any country that face this kind of fiscal crisis. The president has been slow. Her party has not cooperated. The party of other the members of the coalition also had the same sort of irresponsible behavior, and now we are in the crisis we had. This is important for a country like Brazil that has always been, we call it an accelerated country. We had a very deep recession last year, 3.8% contraction of GDP, to be followed by a similar contraction this year. You have to go back to the 1930s to see that in Brazil's history. So this is a disaster. A lot of the gains, and there were many gains from the Lula administration, particularly in terms of rising poor people to the middle classes, expanding opportunities. But then, they really missed the moment of adapting, of changing to preserve those that progress. And now we face this dramatic situation with rising tension. Let's hope that things will not turn violent. I think there is a good chance of controlling the situation because, in contrast with countries like Venezuela and others in the neighborhood, the armed forces, the police forces have not been co-opted by political parties. So they are there. There is no fear and no possibility of a military intervention in Brazil. And the rule of law is being affirmed in Brazil. Unfortunately, it's being affirmed in a moment where we have, progressive or formerly progressive politicians that are now seen as people that have helped to create this mess. And, sure. And this is very, very unfortunate.
Right, and of course Lula famously said there's not a more honest living soul in the country than him, than he is. I thank you for joining us, Paulo Cetera.
Yeah, I would like to believe that, Ian. Sincerely, I like Lula a lot. Actually, I was once his driver here in Washington when he first came in 1981. But most Brazilians are very skeptical now about that statement. Nice to be with you, Ian.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Paulo Cetera, who's the director of the Brazil Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Previously, he was the Washington correspondent for Estado de Sao Paulo, and he also teaches at the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcast and also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.